Man, thanks for having me. Really, kind of cool to be here. I take this off because I was told that they will take me down when it's time. If I'm not done. Gotta tell you, this true story, I don't have a whole lot of sobriety. I have very good sobriety. I've only got about a year. I'll tell you the exact date in a minute, but in my first 3 months of sobriety, and it was really my home group, quite honestly, I'm one of those chronic relapsers. I think I have a kind of a special calling because I know I'm not the only one. I was a chronic relapser until I found my home group. But we have a speaker meeting every Thursday night in Richmond. And I'm not kidding. It's the best overall just lineup of speakers I've ever been to. In my first couple months of sobriety, there's this guy there by the name of Billy H. He came from Madison. It's a true story. And I sat in the back of that room, and I was telling Phil on the way up here, honest to God, truth, I'm not making this up, I had a spiritual experience. It was an awesome talk. And I just sat there, and I got high as hell, and I was just thanking God. Thank you for letting me be a part of this. This is just a special. And we talked a lot after the meeting, and became a pretty good AA buddy, I'd say. But I got to ask, since I've been kind of getting sober, I have learned over the past year to kind of embrace a lot of my fears, things that I didn't want to do, things that scared the hell out of me. Now, instead of cowering to them, I now kind of embrace them. And one of the things I used to have a major fear of doing is talking in front of a group. I mean, a year ago, you would never have seen me do something like this. And because I decided to embrace this fear and probably even got to get good at it, I learned in studying about public speaking that you should never apologize. But I got to be honest with you, I'm going to apologize right up front. And I want to apologize in the sense that I'm going to tell my story the way it is. I'm not going to change names. I heard this one lady speak one time. And she said, I'm old school. I did a lot of things out there. I'm going to confine my conversation, my talk, to alcohol. And I'll be honest with you, I guess I'm new school, because I'm just going to tell you the way it was. And I'm not going to lie to you. When I came into these rooms, I thought I was a drug addict. I'm not kidding you. I thought I was. And Mark, who's my grand sponsor, and my sponsor Phil, and I used to have a lot of debates. And Phil was very, very good to me. He said, Jim, you found something that's working for you. Let's give it a year. And within a year, you'll know. And I got to tell you, even though you'll hear a lot of drugs in my story, I have learned after about 6 months of sobriety that I was a true alcoholic. Was convinced I wasn't, but I am. And so the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. That's not just I just want to stop. I have to not drink. If I drink, my alcoholism will lead me into horrible things very, very quickly. But I just wanted to kind of get that out of the way because I'm still a little sensitive to maybe saying things that people won't like. And I've told my story a few times, and to be honest with you, I think there's a niche for hearing this kind of story because most alcoholics today are not pure alcoholics. And I definitely wasn't. But let me go ahead and start. My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. I belong to the Into Action AA group, home group in Richmond, Virginia. My sobriety date is October 24th, 2007. And I know that's not a whole lot of sobriety, but for this alcoholic, it's an incredible miracle because I tried for years. I got a stack of white chips, literally. I'm not exaggerating, folks. I was a chronic relapser. And hopefully I'll have a little bit of something to say that will, I don't know, add something to your sobriety. Maybe maybe somebody here, I don't know you folks too, maybe some people here have the same kind of condition issues that I had. But I'll tell you kind of how it started out for me. I'm a true, what I consider a true child of the 60s. In 1960, I was 4 years old. In 1970, I was 14. So really, all my conscious awareness of the childhood was in the 60s. The 60s was an extremely weird time to grow up in. I had a somewhat dysfunctional family, two older brothers that were always fighting and parents that didn't know how to deal with them. But the main thing that I remember about the 60s was, and I remember coming, my dad was one of these guys, he'd come home and every night like clockwork after dinner, sit up in his chair and turn on Chet Huckley and Brinkley. And Walter Cronkite wasn't in our home too much, I don't know why, but we watched the Huntley Brinkley Report. And I remember seeing race riots all the time, war protesting all the time, just stuff that as a little kid, 10 years old, it used to disturb the heck out of me seeing this stuff. And I remember even seeing a headline as a 12-year-old or something like that, I don't even know, a headline in the newspaper said, God is dead. And now that'll unnerve you if you're a 12-year-old kid. God is, how the hell do you know? How could you know that? But still, I remember it bothering me. And for whatever reason, I was always kind of a worrier. I was always one of these kids who was always concerned, always worried. And I had an incredibly large degree of lack of confidence. I was extremely self-conscious. I remember high school was pure hell for me. I hated high school. My only goal in life was to be popular, and I just never quite got it. I remember one time when I was in the eighth grade, to tell you how bad I was walking to gym class down the hallway, and Debbie Walker was coming the other way, and I was just like this, and she said, hi, Jim. And I can remember that like it was yesterday, because I'm not kidding. That was the most important thing that ever happened to me. That was just so cool. That head cheerleader, the most beautiful girl in school, would say hello to me. But I really grew up in a neighborhood where I realized I'm a true alcoholic and that I had to be king of everything. In a neighborhood of five or six guys in there, and I was one of the older ones, that worked out good until I got into middle school. I remember I got on the bus in the seventh grade, back then middle school, junior high school, seventh grade. And I'm this little scrawny, skinny, white boy. And I get on the bus, and there's a guy going into the seventh grade, 17 years old, with a full, well, he needed to shave, jean jacket, and was laughing about how he could be drafted to the Vietnam War. And it went down very quickly. School was very tough for me. I was always afraid, always scared, always wanting to be something I wasn't. The only thing that I really had kind of going good for me in the 60s was the Beatles. The Beatles. For anybody who wasn't around to experience that night in February 1964, of seeing them come on that Sullivan, if you weren't blessed to have that experience, let me tell you, I kind of feel sorry for you. I mean, I'll never forget it. It was like the nostalgia when I see those guys up there. It was one of the most special moments of my life. It gave me something to do. A few years later, I bought an electric guitar, a little amp. I started playing in bands. And for the first time, I was doing something that not everybody could do. So that gave me a little bit of something growing up. The first time I got drunk, first time I had a drink, I remember it very well. Me and Greg Driscoll went up to Giant Open Air Market. Giant Open Air Market, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this sort of thing, but back in 1972, I was 16 years old. And Giant Open Air Market was this huge shopping market, grocery store, open 24 hours a day. Back then, that was a whole new thing. And we found a kindly, elderly black gentleman, gave us some money, and he bought us six bottles of Boone's Farm apple wine. And me and Greg and Ricky English and George Farber went down to the River Place. Ricky's, George's grandparents had a river place on the Pamunkey River. And actually, it's a Wacomico River, I think, but anyway, who knows. But the way it was, me and Ricky had three bottles to share, and we both downed one of them. And I'd never had a drink of anything before. So I was 16 years old, first time, and I was pretty drunk. And I opened up the second one, I took a swig, passed it over to Ricky, he took a swig, passed it back, and I said, watch this. And I turned that thing up. And just the whole bottle just went right down. And I'm not going to kid you, I don't remember too much about what happened after that. The only memory I have after that was waking up in the yard almost choking on my vomit. I had a hangover that lasted for 4 days, and I'm not exaggerating. I was sick for 4 days. And in the church that, and I didn't go to church too often, but at the church that I went to, when you take communion, they give you the real stuff. It wasn't grape juice. And I wasn't prepared when I got on my knees and they put the wine chalice and I took the wine, that I gagged right there at the altar. And it was quite embarrassing because I couldn't drink the wine anymore. And for that point forth, whenever I took communion, I would just let it touch my lips. I wouldn't drink it. I did not drink wine again until I was about 35 years old. That's how bad that hangover was. But when I was about 17, I got involved with marijuana. And I don't know if the things are different today than they were then, whether marijuana is better or worse, but typically you didn't get high the first time you smoked it. And I didn't get high the first 20 times I smoked it, and I was determined to get high. And I bought a $10 bag, and I remember a $10 bag was like that much to me. And I rolled one joint after another, and I kept smoking. And finally I thought, well, I've gotten high, I just ain't much to it. I thought it'd be better than this. And I just finally forgot about even trying to get high. And then me and Scott Barker one night, we went out playing around, drinking in bars and stuff, about 17 years old. And I dropped him off, and on the way back to dropping him off, he brought a little joint, we smoked it. I dropped him off, and as I'm driving down Glenside Drive in Richmond, all of a sudden, that stoplight took 3 years to get to, and I realized I finally got high, and I realized, man, I really like that stuff. And I won't tell you too many of the stories of my teenage years. I'll tell you one story. It's kind of just showed you how crazy, even though it was fairly normal for the people that I hung around with to do the things I did. I had a cousin, Jenny, who lived in Stone Mountain, Georgia, lived in Atlanta. And I drove my little 1972 Chevy Vega all the way to Atlanta. And I get there about 8 o'clock at night. And me and Jenny and her boyfriend, Clarence, we each take a hit. And I've never done this stuff before. A four-way sunshine. Took a hit. Went into a big bar called Everybody's, a pizza place, with about 8 of her friends in a big circle and drank. I mean, I got plastered while I was there. And as I'm leaving, I'm really drunk now. And as I'm leaving, this LSD kicks in. And I'm in my car, my little Chevy Vega, and I'm driving in the streets of Atlanta, Georgia, and it's late at night, and it's pouring down rain, and it's a spring. And I'm tripping, and I'm drunk, and I'm trying to drive my car. And I was like, whoa, this is strange. And I was going, dear God, please help me. And next thing you know, I started shrinking. I started getting small. Now, if you've never experienced this before, it's not like you're kind of getting small, but you're literally getting small, and I can't see over, and I'm going, dear God, please help me, make me big, God. And he makes me big, and I'm starting to go, oh, thank you, Lord. And I finally get normal, and the thing is, I don't stop, and I'm kind of, oh, God, okay. And I'm trying to grab a car in the state, and I mean, it's like the crazy things we did. And we went home to Jenny's house. Thank God her father, who was a traveling salesman, was out of town. Because I got home, she turned on the TV set, and I went, dear God, turn off the time machine. I mean, it was really like that. We went up to her bedroom, and I just started feeling real bad, really bad. I didn't know what it was. It was all a mental thing for me at the time, but I got so bad that she got scared. She called her mother, and her mother came in. And her mother comes in like 1 o'clock in the morning with her nightgown on, her head of her hair up in a towel. And I was sitting on the side of the bed, and I looked up and said, who is this, your queen? And I ended up, she called a boyfriend. I ended up grabbing my car keys and trying to leave, and they weren't going to let me leave. And he ended up throwing up all over the living room floor. And I remember before I actually got sick, I was in the bed in the fetal position. And honest to God, I was in a pure and total, utter hell. I was in hell. And I was like this. But what made it so horrible was that not only was it in total and utter torture, I knew I'd be that way for eternity. I'm not kidding. I'm just sitting there wailing. Ended up getting sick all over the house. Somehow, I was waking up the next day. It was about 12 o'clock. And as I'm waking up, Jenny comes into the bedroom. And I looked up to her and I said, Jenny, my God, you don't believe the nightmare I just had. She said, Jenny, what's the nightmare? And I just, oh my God, I never forget that feeling. I mean, I did all that stuff. It was the most horrible feeling I ever had. And you think that would stop me, but it didn't. I kept right on doing all these things. But to kind of get to the essence of what really developed for me. When I was 20 years old, I got in some trouble. And it looked like things could be kind of bad for me. And I made a deal with God. I said, God, you get me out of this trouble. I'll talk with this priest. There was a lady priest at the church that we attended that I actually liked and wanted to talk to, but I had too many wild notes, so I just wanted to talk with some Christian lady. But I made a deal with God that if he'd get me out of this trouble, I'd talk to her. And one day later, I got out of trouble, and I thought, if I knew this was going to happen that quick, I would have made the deal. But I'm one of these guys, if I make a deal, I'm going to stick to it. And I went and talked with this lady at the church, and we talked for like 4 hours. And she changed my life. She really completely. I was at that point in time, I was about 19 years old. I was attending the University of Richmond. I was playing in a rock and roll band. We had played in clubs all around Richmond. This was my life. This is what I wanted to do. And after I left that meeting with her, I called up the guys in my band. I quit the band. I knew that I could not continue that lifestyle and live to her ripe old age and become a Christian, which I did that day. And so I joined the church and became a very, very dedicated Christian. I gave up all drugs, didn't give up alcohol. Alcohol was always in the background for me, as you'll see in a minute. But gave up all drugs, became a Christian. Met my wife. We've been married 30 years now. Met her within 6 months, and a year later we were married. And things actually got kind of good as far as being an alcoholic and that sort of thing. But what happened was we had a kid. 2 years later, we had another kid. 2 years later, another kid. And I was an underwriter at the time for an insurance company, and I didn't want my wife working all the time. What did my kids raise at home? And money was tight. Money was tight as hell. And I made a decision in 1983 to leave a very secure job as an underwriter with a major insurance company and become a salesman. And I'm not kidding. 3 months later, I was begging for my job back. It was not an easy thing to become a... just kidding. But I became a salesman. A lot of stress in being a salesman. And actually, to be perfectly honest with you, I was pretty lucky from the very beginning. My business kind of took off and did well. But somewhere along the line, I took back up smoking pot. And I think I did it because I was self-medicating. I remember one day, I was probably about 30 years old, maybe 32 years old. This time, I had my own little business. And money was okay. You know, I wasn't rich or anything, but money was okay. But I remember being in my office all morning long, and I was just worried. I was just concerned. And there was no really reason to be. Where is the next sale going to come from? How am I going to feed my family? And I remember I went out for lunch, had myself a sub sandwich, 22-ounce beer, and smoked about 3 or 4 hits off a joint on the way back to the office. And I remember sitting down in my office thinking, and I pulled out that joint, I had half a left nut. God, how could anything be wrong with that? This morning, I was scared to death. I was worried. And I was anxious. Not a thing has changed, but now I feel okay. How can there be anything wrong with that? And I remember thinking that, and it just made sense. I felt better. And so I continued to drink on a fairly regular basis and smoke pot on a completely regular basis. Slowly went into it to where I'd smoke it on the way to work. I'd smoke at lunch. I'd have an appointment. Smoke on the way back to the office. Smoke on the way home. Take care of the kids and stuff. Smoke at, I was just all the time. I was a major pothead. And I kept saying, well, you know what? I'm 32 years old. When I'm 35, I'll quit. And when I was 37, I said, well, when I'm 40, I'm going to quit. By that time, I had, because I was one of these guys who never wanted to end up his life, you know, 60, 80, you know, whatever age I was lived to. I didn't want to end up at the end and die and have been a pothead all my life. So, basically, some interesting stuff started happening, like around 40 years of age, 42 years of age. First of all, I met a priest at my church. And you got to understand, at this point, you know, I was a major, major blah. Okay? I lived a life that a lot of people kind of envied. I coached the Little League for 12 years. I coached championship teams. We had a nice little house. The neighbors used to thought everything was perfect in our home. And we were pretty good parents, and I did care a lot about my kids. And but, you know, I had this secret, man. I was always drinking and drugging. Always. And I used to think nobody knew. Later, I found out more people knew than I thought, which I think is probably typical. But I was about 41, 42 years of age, and I met this priest. And, you know, I'm very full of pride and don't like to admit that I'm wrong. And this priest came to me. We were talking, and I was... We kind of really gotten involved with this church. Here I was, you know, drugging every day, trying to become a good church member. And I remember Father Andrew said, Jim, I don't care what sin you commit or how often you commit the sin. The next time you're back at church, you bring it to confession. And I never forget him saying that because it really helped me. Because he was so humble about it. And I had enough nerve to basically go to him in confession and tell them that I smoked marijuana. You know, and I drank a lot too, but I didn't think that was worth confessing. It's always been in the background with me. And I'm not going to kid you, for about a year, it was really hard because when I finally went to confession and admitted this horrible thing that I did, it was so hard that I thought, now I'm cured and I won't smoke again. Well, within a few days I was smoking again. And I'd go back to confession again. And a few days later, I'd smoke again. And this went on for a year. And I'm not going to kid you, it did get better. My addictions, my drinking, things that I was doing that I knew I should be doing, lessened. And they got better. But it was just really hard for me to keep going back, you know, after I commit this sin again. Because every time I went to confession, I thought I should get it this time. And this went on for a year. And I'll never forget, I had an appointment in Southside of Richmond. About 10 o'clock at night, and I was driving home. And I had a little pipe, and I was smoking it, as I always do on the way home. And I finished it. And I said, God, I'm going to try to start again. I'm going to try again. And I was on this two-lane highway, a long stretch of 3 or 4 mile roads, a straight line. Wasn't very well traveled back then. A little bit more now, but not so much back then. And I remember I stopped in the road, and there was a gutter and a drain thing. And I rolled down my window and I went to throw it into the gutter. And it hit the top of the gutter and bounced back on the street. And I started to say, ah, heck with it, and take off. But there was an elementary school right there. And I thought, man, I can't leave that pipe in the street like that. And well, those kids would be walking to school and see that thing. So I put my car in the park and I started to get out. And as soon as I did, rearview lights came up in my rearview mirror. I thought, okay, so I pulled up to the next street, made a U-turn, wait for the car to come by, and I came back. And as soon as, you know, I waited for everything to be clear, as soon as I got to the place, I put the car in park. The same thing happened. The lights came up in the rear view mirror. So I came up by the elementary school, did a U-turn, waited for the car to come by. Nobody's coming. Pull out again, put it in park, and it happened again. Well, it happened again. It happened so many times. I'm sitting going, Lord, this is weird, man. This is freaky. And while it was happening, I'd heard this Christian lady speak. She was a Christian model. I just heard a tape on her originally. And she was one of these famous Christian models. And I just didn't think the world of fashion and Christianity in any way mixed. But evidently it did. She was a Christian model. And she told a story about how they'd marched around these porn houses in New York City, and within 6 months they closed down. Evidently 7 times from the book of something in the Old Testament. I remember reading this. I mean, I remember hearing it, and I was thinking about this. So finally, one time, I get out, I pick up that pipe, I throw it down in the gutter, and I get back in my car, and I count it in my head. 7 times. I didn't take the 7 circles, but I did 7 times. It took 10 minutes for me to get that damn thing in there. And I remember thinking, man, that was weird. God, what the, does that mean anything? Is anything special going on tonight? Was this a spiritual experience? I'm just not aware of it. The next morning, I was looking for pot, making phone calls. I'm like, well, nothing to that thing right there. Nothing happened there. I thought it was something that was just all in my head. But, you know, I didn't know too many people because I tried to keep my little addiction secret, and I didn't know a whole lot of people who did it, but I had 3 guys. One of them was a brother of mine, and 2 other guys, they always had it. And this was a Friday, and he didn't. And it was really tough. What? I can't have what I want? That was really... People say you can't get addicted to marijuana. They're wrong. You get very addicted to marijuana. On Saturday, I was getting really desperate. Calling people from 20 years ago. I hadn't talked in 20 years since high school or whatever. Hey, man, I just thought I'd call you. Oh, Bobby, you still smoke? And, anyway, I couldn't find any. I went out that night. We had a double date with my wife, and... I put down 8 White Russians in a very short order. Got very, very drunk. Got very, very embarrassing drunk. But marijuana always came in. I mean, alcohol always came into my life, but I didn't have other things that I wanted. But the next day I went, on a Sunday, I went to church. And I went to confession. And I'm not going to kid you, this time I had a spiritual experience. I know that I felt my addiction leave. I felt it come out of my body. And at this point in time, I'm about 42 years old. I've been smoking for about 20 years on a very regular basis. I tried to quit 1,000,000 times. One time, honestly, I had a month, and I was completely jonesing it and white-knuckling it and just hating it. And usually I quit 10 minutes later, maybe a day later. I would find my way back to it. But this time, my addiction left. I felt it leave. And it was pretty amazing not having that desire to smoke marijuana anymore. And that was on a Sunday. The next day, I went to my office. And at that time, I had a partner. It's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting there in my office, and Garth walks in. Now, Garth doesn't even smoke pot. He's an alcoholic. We did a lot of drinking together, but he doesn't smoke. He said, Jim, I've not even going through a few things lately. I got a little pot right here. I'm going to stick it in my bottom right-hand drawer. If you ever have any problems, let me know. I'll have some for you. And he walked out of that room and I said, dear God, is that weird or what? Here I just had this experience, and this guy I've known for 10 years does this to me? You know what? But I'm one of these guys, I don't like to hurt anybody's feelings. And I've tried to get beyond that. I knew his heart was in the right place, but he was doing the wrong thing. But I didn't say anything because I knew I had no desire to do that. Well, that was in February. I went for 5 months without drinking and without drugging at all. My life was getting better than it ever had. Getting very involved in my church. Life was just awesome. And what happened was, Garth and I, he's my partner, we'd go out on average about every 2 weeks and shoot pool and drink. And since this experience, I had no desire to do that anymore. But once again, a person who doesn't want to hurt somebody's feelings and doesn't want to, he doesn't say the way he should, you know, how he feels, or I should have. I should have told him I didn't want to do that anymore. Because he asked me to go out, and I kept saying, no, I've got something to do. But after 5 months, I realized that he was getting his feelings hurt. So I said, yeah, man, we'll go out tonight. So we went out to shoot pool about 5 o'clock after work. Started drinking beer, and I'm just drinking, and I'm drinking. Because I don't think I have an alcohol problem. About 7 o'clock, my mind starts thinking about that marijuana. About 8 o'clock, it's like really thinking. By 9:30, it's screw it, Garth. Is that stuff still up there? Yeah, I got pretty drunk that night. And that addiction, whatever, alcoholism gets run. He said, yes, there. So we basically went out and got some rolling papers. I went back into my room. I rolled it. I smoked it. And all I got to tell you is this. If God ever gives you a gift, do not take it back in his face. I knew instantly that I'd screwed up in a major way. And talk about things getting bad. Well, now I was smoking instantly just as much as I was. Now I was drinking every night, just about every night during the week, going out, leaving my family at home, telling them, lying about why I was out, shooting pool 4 or 5 nights a week, drinking, smoking all the time. I was miserable. And this continued till Christmas of that year. Around Christmas time, I was invited to a party, a Christmas party after work. At the party, I probably had about 3 to 5 drinks, I don't remember. All I remember is I got a pretty good buzz. And on the way home, I decided I'd stop at my brother's house, smoke a little joint, cap off the evening, and go home. When I get there, my old lost cousin Alex was there. Alex came from that part of the family that we considered, well, the bad part of the family. Alex had been out of prison. These are some crazy people. And I kind of avoided them, but there he was. And they were smoking something. And I said, what are you guys doing? And they go, we're smoking cocaine. Now, I got to tell you, they didn't say the word crack. They said cocaine. And I can't convince you anybody of this, but I'm convinced myself. I believe a veil was pulled over my vision. If you read the Bible, there are several times in the Bible where people can't see something that's right before them. I'm not a naive person. I'd even done a term paper in college on drug addiction. I think I had some type of premonition of what was in store for me. I'd read articles about how addictive crack cocaine was. But they didn't say crack, they said cocaine. And so I said, I didn't know you could smoke cocaine. Just like that. And I'm not kidding. If I'd known that they'd used the word crack, I can't swear I wouldn't have smoked it that night. But I can swear this, I never would have smoked it again. Because I know how addictive it is. So I took a hit off this cocaine and blew it. And, you know, I'd done cocaine probably 20 times. I don't know. It's crazy when it was around over the years. It was never that big a deal for me. Maybe I didn't do enough. I always thought marijuana was a better mood-altering substance. And I took this hit and blew it out and looked up at Alex and went, whoa. I never had cocaine like that before. And that happened. Took a few hits, left. Didn't really think much about it. 2 weeks later, I'm at my office. Alex shows up around 5 o'clock out of nowhere. Says, Jim, let's go out and take a few hits. And again, really one of these personality defects I've had to work on. I do not like disappointing people. I do not like saying no to people. I didn't want to, and I said, okay. We went out and did it. 2 weeks later, he shows up again. 2 weeks later, he shows up again. Like the 4th or 5th time now I'm smoking this stuff. I'm getting ready to take a hit, and I look at Alex, and I go, Alex, is this crack? And he said, well, he just burst into laughter is what he did. And, but you see, the veil was uncovered, but I thought now I could handle this thing. I've done it 4 or 5 times. I'm not addicted. I'm not looking for it. And a very, very slow progression over several years, I became a crack addict. And I know a lot of people might be wondering, what has it got to do with alcohol? Let me tell you. I tried to quit smoking crack so many times, and I'd go and drink instead. And when I drink, that mind goes, and I got to go get it. And I can't tell you how many times I'd stop smoking and quit, and alcohol being the one drug that I thought was okay I could take would put me right back into that, and I'd go out and do it again. And this went on for 5 years until I was at the end of my rope, and I was in pretty bad shape. And I wasn't one of these guys who lost everything. I didn't lose everything. I still had a house. I owed IRS major amounts of money. But interiorly, I was in pretty bad shape. And believe it or not, I kept this thing a secret my entire 5-year period. because I could be out of town lots of times, and I have a river place that I can go to, and I'd be going there to work. I'd really be going there to do crack cocaine. And I'd really be going to town. I'd really be getting a hotel room right in town and doing what I wanted to do. And I did this for years. And my life just became, I guess, about as bad as a life can get. And my wife ended up getting separated. Didn't know why. She just knew I was gone. We ended up separating. And I'll never forget. It kind of just went straight downhill. One day, I finished off one of my binges. And I was in my car in front of my office. And I was trying to make a decision on what to do. Part of me wanted to go inside and work because, you know what, things were getting pretty bad financially. And I needed to work. Another part of me wanted to go out and get some more drugs. And I couldn't make a decision. And when you come off this stuff, you're already pretty depressed. It's not very much fun to come down. And I sat there in my car. And I just got depressed. Full despair. I could not move. I could not make a decision. And after 45 minutes of trying to make this decision, I went into a state of despair that was just like unbelievable. I won't say I thought about suicide. I didn't really think about committing suicide. But for the first time in my life, I understood those who did. Because I always thought people who committed suicide were weak people and were selfish people. And now for the first time I had an understanding of someone who could do that. And I just sat there and I kept thinking, God, I was saying it out loud, God, I don't know what to do. God, I just don't know what to do. God, I don't know what to do. And at that moment I had what I consider another spiritual experience. I actually heard words. And it wasn't mind-blowing, didn't blow me out of the car. But I heard words, distinct, audible words come from the inside, and the words were, all you have to do is honor him. And I went, whoa. All of a sudden I had a little bit of hope. Hope kind of crept into the situation. And for me, him was God, my personal high power, Jesus Christ. And how can I do that? But I had hope now. I had a little bit of hope. And so it crept in. And I thought, you know, the first thing you got to do, if you're going to honor him, first thing you got to do is you can't have this kind of secret going on. So I had the first of three meetings where the hardest things I did. First of all, I called my wife, who were separated. Said, I got something I got to say. We got to meet tonight. Sitting down. Told her all this stuff's going on, and she just flipped. She just could not believe it. I couldn't believe what I got myself into. She couldn't believe it. We met with a priest at our church. The priest at our church basically, her and him ganged up on me. Said they wanted me to go into a treatment program. I said, I don't want to go to a treatment program. I've admitted this now. I think I can do it on my own. I remember Father Mark saying, Jim, if your car is broken, you put it in a place and get it fixed. If you got a problem, go where the experts are and get it fixed. And I was pissed. I didn't like that answer. But I had a few days to think about it, and I finally decided to do it. And I got on the internet, and I plugged in Christian Rehab. And I looked for all sorts of places, and I found a place out in Laguna Beach, California. And people say, why don't you go someplace in Richmond? Man, I didn't want to go anywhere where I might see another human being I know or might know me. So I went out to California, and I went to a 28-day program. And I'm not kidding you. I'll never forget when I had my little bag, and I was walking through that steps, and I go into that door, and I was going, dear God, can you believe where I've gotten myself? How could anybody? I mean, I guess I was just an egotistical maniac. Like, how could you get to this level? You freaking loser. You're such a loser, and you're going to hang out now with a bunch of losers. And ended up having the best 4 weeks of my life. I loved it. People there that I thought were going to be a bunch of losers were smart. They were artistic. They were funny. I made friends that I still have today, and it's like, wow. I thought these people were losers. And I guess we're not all losers, but anyway. When I was on my airplane back to Richmond, Virginia, this was 5 years ago, almost to the day, I was convinced without a doubt that I would never drink, that I would never drug again forever. In fact, I would have bet my right arm. I knew it. I had all the tools. I had the most wonderful experience. I was ready to jump into AA and be. So I got back and started going to about 3 or 4 meetings a week. And exactly 28 days later, my life got weird. I got scared. I got anxious. I got depressed. I don't know why. I stuck it out for 2 weeks. On day 58, I couldn't take it anymore. I made the phone call and got right back where I was. And I'm not going to kid you. I never got really as bad as I was. But I was in and out of the AA rooms for 4 years at that point. When I had that first relapse, it took me a year and a half to get back in. I was right back where I was. Maybe not quite as bad as often, but pretty bad. And I can't even think of another white chip. In that 4 year period, no question, I picked up 30 to 40 to 50, I mean, no white chips. It was so bad that I used to find new meetings just so I could pick up a white chip where I wouldn't know anybody. I was so embarrassed to pick up more white chips. I'm just grateful to God that I didn't give up and I kept picking up white chips. But at the end there, in that 5 year period, after my first rehab, I went to 3 more rehabs. So I became very good at understanding this disease, which I thought cured me. Once I understood why I was doing it, it'll make a better difference if you understand why you're doing it. But what happened was, things got really kind of bad. My family was begging me to go to another rehab. I remember coming on one day and I had this big fat envelope with Dad on it. And I'm like, oh, God, I don't want to read this. A letter from my daughter. Man, there's nothing worse than reading a letter from your daughter when you're right in the middle of addiction and alcoholism. And that I read it because I had to. But they all wanted me to go to another rehab. And my question was, why? I've been to 4. I haven't gotten sober going to 4 rehabs. Why do you think another one's going to work? You got to do something. You got to do something. Well, I don't know. Something's got to be something I'm missing. And in this 4 years, I actually did a little bit of research on AA. In fact, since I've read all the books now, I've got a little bit of historical stuff in my armor. And I kept thinking, you know, think about those guys back in 1939, 1940. The end of the road alcoholic. Now, you're the end of the, I was in these treatment centers. I know the end of the road alcoholic is bad as any drug addict, heroin, crystal meth, anything. End of the road alcoholic has got it pretty bad. And these guys were end of the road alcoholics. And they went to 1 meeting a week. And they never went to a rehab. And they got sober. And this used to play, man, what am I missing? And somehow my recovery became going to meetings. Remember I said I started going to 3 or 4 meetings a week? By the end, when I relapsed, I started going to 1 meeting every week or every day. I'd relapse again, I'd double up, I'd go to 1 at lunch and 1 in the night. I got to the point where I was going to 12 meetings a week and still relapse. And all I remember hearing was, just don't drink and go to a meeting. To me, that's what AA was. And that's not what AA is. It really isn't. It's not going to meetings. I didn't know that. I went on one of my 2-day binges. And I'll never forget. There's a place in Richmond called Rebos. I'd never been to Rebos in that 4 year period. I was in pretty bad shape, pretty run down, looked pretty ragged. I went to Rebos and picked up a white chip. Called my sponsor on the way home. He fired me. I was pretty PO'd about that. Called you and told you to pick up a white chip and you're going to fire me? Okay, yeah, whatever. Now, the next day, I was just trying to do something to occupy my brain, my head. I went to see a movie. It was called Borat. I'll never forget the feeling of being totally depressed and laughing watching this movie. the middle of the afternoon all by myself. Just have to do something to occupy the brain when I'm coming down off the stuff. And I got out of my car, and I'll never forget, I said, God, I want to go to a real meeting. That's exactly what I said. I want to go to a real meeting. I want to go to a down and dirty meeting where people like me. And I've been to almost every meeting in Richmond area at that point. And I saw this meeting called Into Action. And it said, 7 o'clock, Tuesday, Thursday, 32nd Street. If you know anything about Richmond, I didn't know where exactly this meeting was, but 32nd Street. Man, that should be some good, damn dirty people like me there. And so I called my wife and said, do a map quest. I want to find out how to get there. She gave me directions. And I went into that meeting, and I was still in pretty bad shape. I hadn't had any sleep in like 3 days. Picked up the white chip the night before, but you don't sleep too good when you do things I do. And very friendly people. But I remember being pretty shocked at the end of the meeting. A guy stood up, and he said, I'm the chairman of the PI committee. We try to get the knowledge of AA out to the public. I'm part of the public information committee, and this is what we're doing in that vein. Another guy stood up and said, hi, my name is Mark. I'm chairman of the corrections. We're working on taking this thing to the Richmond City Jail. We're working on taking this thing to the Powhatan State Prison. And we've got all these other things to do. Another guy stood up and said, I'm the CPC chairman. And what we try to do is carry it to the professional that meets the alcoholic, you know, right down at his level, you know, in the streets, the policemen, the judges, the doctors, the lawyers. We try to get it to these people who meet them to have a place to refer to. Another guy stood up and said something. Another guy, and I went, wow, what a meeting. I've never seen this before. These guys are doing something. And at the end of it, they said, we're really big on sponsorship. If you don't have a sponsor, we suggest that you talk to one of the home group members. Tonight with home group members, do your secret signal. So they did. And I went up to the guy who greeted me when I walked in. And he was real friendly. And Brian said, Jim, we've only got 3 months. Let me talk to Andy. Andy had a lot of time clean, but he looked at me and said, hey, Phil, come here. So we got Phil over there, and Phil became my sponsor that night. And that's been a year now. And for me, that's an absolute miracle. And I really think that I've found that I've been taught a lot of things about what AA really is. See, I'm talking opinion here. This is my opinion. AA, to a large degree, has gotten watered down. This is my opinion. A lot of meetings to just talk about what's going on in their life, that sort of thing. But those guys in 1935, they had one meeting a week. The rest of the week, they were finding people who needed to hear the message. In fact, I remember when I was in the first treatment, I had underlined one thing in the book, and I was looking at it the other night recently, and it really stuck out. I said, yeah, that stuck out then. Why did I never know that? And maybe I did know it, but maybe I just didn't know how to. And that's why I'm so grateful to Into Action. They showed me how. But the one thing that stuck out was, and this is paraphrased, I'm going to have it exactly, but Bill Wilson said, when all else failed, in other words, when I'm getting ready to drink, I found another alcoholic to try to help. And see, that to me has been the key. I am now the public information chairman. And that's been really a lot of fun to do that. We got a cable TV show coming up, a live call-in cable TV show every week that we're doing. We already did it for 5 weeks. We're going to do it every week next year. We're making a video to play on local cable access channels. We got an Into Action phone that is manned 24 hours a day with our Into Action business card that has this phone number on it. We give it to people all the time. We have nurses come in, and we have doctors come in, and we give them bunches of our cards. When you meet these people, you know, at the point of crisis, once you give them this card. And for me, the secret has been carrying the message. You know, it's funny, when Phil was became my sponsor, and I was sitting in his living room telling him that I didn't think I was an alcoholic, he said, well, find out. And him and Mark, when they heard my story, they just kept arguing, you are an alcoholic, pal. listen, Jim, people who normally have four drinks, they go out and try to find crack cocaine. I mean, that's that kind of makes sense to me. But they were so good, just give yourself a chance to find out whether you are or not. I cannot drink. There's no question that I cannot drink. I know for a fact that I could pick up one beer and drink it and put it away. I could do that. I'm not that far. But if I allow myself to do that, I guarantee it, just a matter of time, I'll be drinking to get drunk, and then I'll be doing other things that would blow my life out of proportion. But this group has showed me that carrying the message is a secret. It is honest to God the way it stays over. And when I first met Phil, and he became my sponsor, he told me he only went to two meetings a week. And I went, damn, I got the wrong sponsor. You see? Because I thought that being a good AA guy meant you went to lots of meetings. He goes, well, hold on, Jim. We also go into jail on Wednesday night and carry the message. We also go to a treatment facility on Monday night and carry the message. We also go to detox at Chippenham Hospital on Saturday night and carry the message. Oh, okay. So now, I only go to two meetings a week. Here's a guy who used to go to 14 meetings a week, 12 or 14 meetings a week. I go to two meetings a week now. But Tuesday night, they had me talking before the group on the topic of the 11th step, improving our conscious contact with God, which was awesome. Just for me to do it, because I had to spend time, you know, studying that concept. Monday night, we went into the treatment center and carried the message. I spoke for 10 minutes, one of the guys spoke. And then guys come up to you and talk to you and want to go out and want to ask you, I got four sponsees now. And I don't, you know, if anybody wants me to be the sponsee. But carrying the message, trying to help the still suffering alcoholic. All I know is, folks, I wanted it bad. I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get it. I couldn't figure out why all these other people were getting it and I couldn't get it. And then I found a home group that carried the message the way I think it's supposed to be done. And I kind of got it. Now, I don't want to be too cocky here and say I got it, because, whoa, that's a big mistake. But I can tell you this sobriety is different. And I honestly believe if I keep doing the things that I'm doing, as this home group has taught me how to do, honestly believe if I do that, I won't drink again. Don't make any promises. Stop doing that. All bets are off. So that's the only thing I would encourage you guys and ladies. The whole point of this thing, Bill wrote a book. The title of his book is Pass It On. He doesn't want to help somebody get sober unless he can help somebody else get sober. That's the whole secret. And that's one thing I've learned from being a part of Into Action. But anyway, thank you very much. That's what I got.